No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey and the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and that affect the lives of all of us. So join in the conversation by calling in at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Or you can Skype your questions in to BBSRADIO and the number 1. Tonight we don't have a guest. It's just Maria and I. There's so much to talk about that we're going to try to squeeze it all in. I don't know if we can.
We always, Maria, run out of time, Michael.
We always run out of time.
And I, when you say tonight we don't, I'm always like, yes, that's because we have so much to talk about. Somebody else would distract us.
That's exactly right. And you know what? I hope everybody there out there had a great Thanksgiving. I know I did. And I hope we all, went over all the things that we have to be thankful for, because if you're living in America today, I think you've got a lot to be thankful for. Well, I'm thankful for Maria.
And I'm thankful for you, Michael, and this opportunity that we get to have some intelligent conversation about news of the day, which is what I love about the program being on Sunday. We kind of get to recap what happened from broadcast to broadcast. And Thanksgiving is a time of gratitude. And one of the things that I've started doing, it's been about a handful of years now, I have a coterie of girlfriends that if it weren't for them, I don't know where I'd be in my life. And so I start sending Thanksgiving cards instead of Christmas cards.
Oh, that's
and
nice.
It's a time to stop down and to thank them for their friendship and for how much they mean to me, and it doesn't get lost in the swirl of what goes on with Hanukkah and Christmas,
right,
and whatever else people celebrate at the end of the year, and it kind of just sets it apart. And I've really liked the fact that I remember to do it.
Right. Well, you know. Well, I used to be a direct mail consultant for 25 years at a direct mail consulting firm. We did political mail, and that was it. You never mailed anything between Thanksgiving and the first of the year, because that was known as the dead zone. You know, you send, or the Bermuda Triangle, we used to call it sometimes. You send mail out, but nothing would ever come back, because there's just too much going on during that period.
Ironically, though, that's when a lot of people make their end of the year donations to whatever charities or nonprofits or 501c3s or what have you. And I know that's part of the messaging that gets out, too. Now, of course, with the internet, we get it electronically. I happen to like snail mail. I also like getting a newspaper every day and turning the pages. I also like reading books. So I know I'm an anomaly. But something that you have to open and then you pull out and you read, and somebody wrote with their own handwriting. It's so rare these days that when I get it, instead of an e-vite and it's actually in the mail, it's like, wow, how refreshing is that? It just seems to be more personal, more intimate,
right,
I think.
Well, that's absolutely true. And we found that out. We used to do mail for a shelter for battered women here in Washington, for example. And the most effective mail we ever had was when we had volunteers that would sit there and address the envelopes. And it was funny because, you know, a lot of these were nice little old retired ladies, and some of the penmanship was real nice, and some of it was real sloppy, and some of it was kind of shaky, but it didn't matter. It seemed that people liked the idea that somebody actually put thought into sending them something rather than just having a machine spit it out. So
even as something as simple as a handwritten address instead of a sticker that's been printed. Yep. Yeah, that I never thought about that, but that makes sense too. It's like the human touch.
Yeah.
Which kind of leads us to your story that's going on with anonymity and the lack of human touch. So why don't we talk about that first, what you have going on in your own backyard?
Yeah, and the speed at which the internet works is the thing that's amazing to me. But just before I say that, before we talk about that, let's talk about our guest last week, Michael Bear. He's up to 580,000 signatures on his petition to eliminate the Electoral College. So it's still growing, but he's lost a lot of momentum, it looks like, because he did 550,000 signatures in 10 days. And in the last 7 days, he's gotten about 30,000 more. So that's a recap on that. But what Maria is talking about is that there's a place here in Washington, a little restaurant called Comet Ping Pong Pizza. And it's a favorite of ours because we've done several fundraisers there for my campaigns, and we've done my victory party was there twice, once when I won, once when I didn't. It's an amazing place, and my assistant, my trusty assistant and brilliant strategist, Rachel Bernard, is the bartender there at night. There was a email that was reported on WikiLeaks, that was part of the group that Comey was taking a second look at, and it was between the owner of the restaurant and John Podesta. And what happened is that in the email, it said something about having a pizza party, and some nut conspirator decided that pizza party was a slang term for molesting children and put it out on the internet that this is a place where children get molested. It's crazy. It's crazy. It's such a family-friendly place. The reason it's called Comet Ping Pong and Pizza is because they have big ping pong tables in the back for kids to play with, and parents love that. They come in, they have a glass of wine, they have their pizza, and their kids are right, 10 feet away playing ping pong and having a good time until the pizza arrives, instead of sitting at the table squirming and being fidgety. So
And looking at their electronic devices.
Actually, they're interacting with something. That's
exactly
right. And it's a cool place, and it's a lovely place. But people that have never been there, right, to just pick this up on the internet, have picked it up and run with it with the most absurd story, and the story continues to grow. One of the things that they've now added to the story is that there's a sign, a neon sign over the restaurant, and they say it has satanic symbols on it. Well, actually, the sign was an old neon sign, which is really cool, that sat over a liquor store in Adams Morgan, a neighborhood in Washington, for like 50 years. And when they went out of business, so that the sign wouldn't be destroyed, Comet bought the sign and put it over their own restaurant. So it's not even their sign. But the point is that this is growing and growing, and there's so much internet chatter. People are coming into the restaurant. They're trying to record people. The police have had to remove people from the restaurant. The Washington Post ran an editorial in yesterday's paper condemning people that were doing this and harassing this poor guy that's just trying to run one of his several restaurants. And it's just crazy. Overnight, this has become a sensation where there's all sorts of chatter on the internet about it. And the thing is, none of it's true. None of it's based in any fact whatsoever. It was just something that somebody made up, and it's out there on the internet, and it's getting all sorts of play.
And it's this crazy. Is right now in real time that you're talking about this story.
This it is right now in real time. Right. And yesterday's Washington Post, they read an editorial about how crazy it was. Now, the upside of that is that people are coming into the restaurant.
Right.
Right. They're like, you know, I don't know if they're fascinated with the story or whether I think some of them are just trying to be supportive because they're so outraged that, you know, this would be perpetrated against such a nice family place. And I can tell you, no children have ever been sacrificed. They there's rumors that they sacrifice children in the back of the restaurant.
When does it become your Second Amendment right? And when is it slander and libel?
I think that this, you know, the Post pointed out that this qualifies for slander and libel. But the point is, you know, the trouble is, who do you sue for it? Right?
I guess that IP address that first sent it out would be a start.
Yeah, and it's probably some guy living in his mother's basement who's got $12 to his name. So, you know, my sister was an attorney, and she said that was the first rule of law. Never sue anyone who's broke. it just doesn't get you anywhere. So,
Kids were telling me yesterday, I had a delayed Thanksgiving, and they said that they've got some IP blocker that they use because they know that there is no anonymity. So anybody who has nefarious intentions, they obviously would have that in play, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I don't think the restaurant, you know, I think the thing that's bothering the restaurant is all the chatter that's going on and the fact that they get a call every 5 minutes. They're trying to run a business, and every 5 minutes, even at 2 o'clock in the morning, they're getting calls, you know, are saying just disgusting things on the phone to their servers and their hostess. And, you know, I think that's what's bothering them. I think anybody that's ever been to the restaurant, this is a kind of a neighborhood restaurant that depends on repeat business.
Right.
So people know the restaurant. You know, I'm sure that anybody that's ever been to the restaurant would just laugh if they read the kind of stuff that, or be outraged by what's going on the internet. But I think it's just the disruption and the fact that their employees are affected by this, and they're getting death threats.
Ridiculous.
The owner and employees at the restaurant. So the police have the restaurant under surveillance. They had to throw people out last week who were causing trouble. I mean, it's just crazy. And why you would, it's like you can put anything out there and people believe it.
And that's the thing. It used to be the adage was there's no such thing as bad PR. But
right.
I don't know now with this anonymity and the viral thing and the put my trolls and everything else, maybe that's not true anymore.
Right. And you know what? The problem is it's the perfect medium for bullies. Right.
Yes, it is.
It's the perfect medium for bullies. And you know, where you know, I'm a politician and people say horrible things about me. I mean, the funniest recently is some guy got in a fight with me on the internet and wrote a letter that it was embarrassing that I had such a terrible dye job on my hair. And my wife and I laughed, you know, because I was just commenting a few weeks ago, I'm starting to get gray hair. I've never dyed what little hair I have left. I've never dyed, you know, but it's just funny. It's like no matter what people put out there, and then other people add in, they go, yeah, that is a terrible dye job. You know, I mean, it's crazy. And that's right. We say that in politics, that's the old adage. You know, there's some things like the question is, have you stop beating your wife?
Yes.
There's
yes.
no way to answer that question, right?
Right.
You can't answer yes or no. So, you know, people just throw stuff out there, and it's the perfect medium for bullies, and we all have to stand up against it. And we were going to have the manager from Comet on, but I don't think he wants to make any bigger deal of it than
it's already been made
of it.
So, I mean, good for them
but
that they're profiting from
people.
It.
Yes, well, go. Their business hasn't fallen off. And if you're out there and you're in Washington, D.C., go not only to support them. They make the best damn pizza I've ever had. They make the best pizza I've ever had. Yeah.
Wow.
They make all sorts of weird pizzas. You know, Mrs. Brown likes them because they make a thing called Yaley, which is a white clam pizza. And it's like, no, Mr. Brown is all about pepperoni and sausage, you know, those types of things. But they make little individual pieces and they're out of this world and they're the nicest people in the world. And don't
you don't have any skin in this game, right?
Well, I got Rachel. So make sure you tip her. Make sure you tip her because I don't pay her nearly enough. So she really needs to make ends meet.
So you can join Melania Trump's cause with cyberbullying when she becomes first lady, which there's rumors that she might not move into the White House until Barron's academic semester school year is complete.
Well, that seems like a reasonable thing to me, doesn't it seem?
Well, I mean, and she's commuting from New York City. It's not that far.
Yeah, and imagine how much I don't know how old Barron is, but
he's 10.
He looks to be imagine what a disruption this is in his life. He's probably the youngest person to move into the White House since
Amy Carter.
Yeah, was young, and the younger Obama girl was young, because the older one's only 18, so they were both young. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that must be a terrible, terrible adjustment. Now, the good news for Melania Trump is that there are plenty of really top-notch private schools here in Washington.
I would assume, with the amount of folks that you have that would demand that.
Yeah, well, Sidwell Friends, where the Obama girls went, is amazing school. And Holton Arms, which is where the Ford children went, where the Ford daughter went, is a great school. And, yeah, there's a lot of them. And I think Amy was the last one to go to public school. And, you know, it'd be nice if you were president of the United States and you could send your kid to public school. But I think those days are over.
I don't know about you, but I sent my children to Catholic school. I went to Catholic school and I live in a blue ribbon school district, top 100. People move to my zip code so their property taxes will pay for their public school education for their kids. But there was something about the religion aspect and the respect that I know they would get in the Catholic system, but everybody else had no problem with, I've got a girlfriend, her daughter graduated valedictorian and went and got a full ride in water polo at Dartmouth and then the son to whatever, but they went through the public school system and obviously they didn't suffer at all from that, but still.
No, and I can tell you, if I were to see a nun in a habit, I would just immediately put my hands out, expecting to be whacked for say here.
You were that kind of student, were you?
Well, I was a talker, Nuns don't like talkers,
I don't know about you. Didn't you have, I had 50 students to a classroom with one teacher and no teacher's aide and no parent. Volunteers. Yeah. So you have to toe the line. We've got that amount of size in front of you.
Well, imagine,
Brown is chit-chatting, you're distracting.
I was a gym teacher's dream student. I had no athletic ability whatsoever, and I was the class clown. So every gym teacher I ever had wanted me dead, I think. But and I was in public school mostly. My only interaction with nuns was in Christian indoctrination. You know what I mean? We used to call it CCD classes. We went to make our confirmation, our communion. And so I went to after school programs with nuns. I never actually, my brother and sister went to Catholic schools, but they saved me from that fate. But still, I think that what we found out, and I don't want to digress here because we've got a lot to talk about, but my kids all went to public schools, and they went to a big public school. And my son, who's now in college and doing great, public school was the wrong place for him. We shouldn't have kept him there. His sisters, it was fine. But so I think a lot of it depends on the kid.
Absolutely. Yeah. And now all four of my children claim to be apathetic agnostics, so it didn't do anything as far as their spiritual journey to what I view as our God. But they got a great education, and they're good people, and they're happy, and that's all that I care.
Well, my kids, too, and I was the youth group leader at church, and they tell me they're agnostic, and I go, what do you mean?
I wonder if it's a millennial thing.
I say, well.
Because we had some interesting, because I think I've mentioned in prior broadcasts, my sons were all Bernie supporters and then moved over to Clinton. And so this was our first gathering post-election.
How did that go?
It, I just love the fact that we agree to disagree like you and I do on some matters, but it never gets below the belt. It never gets pejorative or name calling. It's like, I'm not quite sure why you see it that way. Here's how I saw it. We even went through the initiatives because in California, we had 17 that we had to vote on propositions and stuff. And one of my sons was like, I'm really glad that 3 days before the election, I did some research and you know how they're written isn't really how it's intended and how it actually unfolds. And I was like, look at you. So at least I helped to raise good civic people. Yeah. On the planet, who do our register vote and who do vote?
Well, you know, that's the old adage that behind every successful child stands a parent who's amazed. You know, right? We all get, when they get older, they start doing stuff. They're like, I told him 10,000 times, and I never thought he heard me. And look, he's doing it. Yeah, I mean, it's always amazing, I'm surrounded by Hillary support. 92% of the people in D.C. voted for Hillary, so you know, it hasn't been a problem yet. But everybody in my extended family on my wife's side, on you know, not everybody, but the contingent in Pennsylvania, of which are about six people that were very close to my sister-in-law, brother-in-law, father-in-law, they're all Trump people. And we got together with them just before the election. So
that
we
was for your father-in-law's birthday, right?
Yeah, for my father-in-law's birthday, right? And we haven't seen him since, so we haven't seen that part. And I'll continue. But at Thanksgiving dinner for us, they were all Hillary people lamenting. And I bet. So before we get into the Trump appointments, which is something we want to talk about, let's just quickly dismiss all this stuff, which I'm really – I'm not really in favor of, but they're doing a recount in Wisconsin, as you know, Jill Stein. I'm not exactly sure why Jill Stein is behind this, since she got the least amount of votes from everybody. She got less votes than that guy that couldn't tell you who one world leader was, the libertarian guy, you know.
But yeah, she's also saying that she's going to pursue additional ones in Pennsylvania and Michigan, not just in Wisconsin.
Yeah, and what a coinkydink that is, right? I mean, just honest. Let's be honest. I'm a Democrat. Now, what would happen if it was overturned in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin? It wouldn't do anything for Jill Stein, but Hillary Clinton would win. You know, and so this is the thing that bothers me a little bit. It's over. We really need to step up to the plate and accept that. It's like a football game where the game's gone by and you look at the tapes the next day and you see a penalty that shouldn't have been called. Okay, but the game's over. It's over. You don't get to go back and replay it. And the same thing, you know, is going on here. If you want to sign Michael Barr's petition, you want to end the Electoral College, that's great. Let's end it for the next election.
Moving forward.
But you can't interfere with that which has already happened. So
Hillary's campaign is going to be participating in the recount.
Yes.
Even though her campaign manager said that they found no evidence of election tampering.
Of course. You know. Now, in this, the only thing I can say is maybe it's part of, you know, the stages of grief, and the first stage of grief is denial, you know, and maybe they're still in the denial phase. But it's time to get over the denial phase, guys. The election's over. I mean, look at how close the Gore election was. If Al Gore could stand up and say it's over, it's time for you guys to stand up and say it's over.
We need to
move on.
Nice. I like that, with the stages of grief.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. It's like
it might be, Michael.
We can't believe it, you know, and so we're gonna, you know, and right, you've lost people, and I've lost people, Maria, and everybody has, and there is part of you that just, you know, in the face of all logic, there's a piece of you inside that feels like you're gonna see that person walk through the door, or you're gonna find out that you know, it was all a big mistake, or right, because you so desperately want that person in your life and you're so full of grief that with the realization that they won't be, that you can't accept it. Maybe that's where we are. Maybe that's where the Hillary people, I'm a Hillary person. I this is what I do, though, you know. So, it was my friend Harry Truman, I think, that said, if you can't take the heat, get out of the kitchen. I work in the kitchen, so I'm used to the heat.
And the adage, which we somehow got to get one that's not a sexist, but this is what separates the men from the boys, you know. Put on your big boy pants and get on with it.
Right.
And to let the listeners know about the stages of grief, denial is the first. And then it's followed by anger and bargaining, depression, and then finally acceptance. So you may have actually hit something on the head. Sounds like an op-ed to me.
Well, as my dear old daddy used to say, better to be lucky than good. So maybe I did luckily hit something on the head. But yeah, and you know what? Much to her credit, I have to say that it seems that Hillary Clinton's accepted it. She came right out and said, you know, and accepted it. It's the people that are supporting her that don't seem to be able to wrap their heads around it, and it's too bad they need to.
Well, by the way, in a different vein, but along the same line, there are Trump people who are saying, if you let Mitt Romney be a part of your candidacy, your presidency, we're going to be upset because we supported you and he didn't. And how can you do that to us? So that's kind of spinning it another way in, you know, acceptance.
Well, you know, it's really funny because I went to a thing not long ago where a congressman from Virginia said, you know, this is how politics works, right? You reward the people that help you and you hurt you work against the people that don't help you. You hurt those that don't help you, you help those that do help you. And unfortunately, that's true. And there is that sentiment in politics. This guy's name is Tom Davis, and he's a socially liberal Republican from Virginia who we admire very much.
Wow.
Here. He's been very helpful. But there's a lot of truth to that, right? That's the way they play the game. You're on our team. And you know, it's not just his rank and file supporters that have said this about Mitt Romney. Rudolph Giuliani and other people have come. I mean, not Giuliani, but the former speaker, Newt Gingrich, has come out and said the same thing. We don't want Trump because Trump didn't want us. I mean, we don't want Romney because Romney didn't want us. And so, yeah, I think Romney, I don't know if he's ever been under serious consideration by Donald Trump. I hope he has.
His name is still very much in the news.
It's very much in the news, but I don't think he's going to make it just on that basis, on the basis of the fact that, the loyalists don't
want. Well, I'm surprised for that reason why Giuliani hasn't been offered something by now. He was on the road with him over 100 days. I mean,
Giuliani's going to get something. And
why hasn't he yet? You know, just like he offered Ben Carson, which I heard two things that he had accepted and that they had misspoken for him about housing and urban development. Because one story came out and said he accepted it. And then there was another story that came out and said he's still considering it.
Yeah. And there's another story that came out that said he refuses to work in government. So he's not going to take, you know, so it's not likely that he's going to take it. But I think that the truth probably lies somewhere in the middle, that maybe he's thinking about it who knows, maybe even in trying to figure out what his other options are. But, you know, I've had people write me and ask me questions about getting involved in the reformation of the Democratic Party, feeling that the Democrats need to move now. They've just had this big loss and they need to. Well, I don't know what's going on the Republican side. I can only speculate. But on the Democratic side, it's not a reorganization like people are sitting down in the boardroom deciding what they're going to do. It's more like a knife fight between street gangs over who's going to win. And I assume it's the same thing inside the Trump campaign to a certain extent, that there are people in that are there are different factions, and that's really what's going to make the difference. And it's up to Trump, I guess, to decide which faction wins. But I bet there's a large faction within inside the Trump camp that doesn't want Romney. And
I don't know about large, but I would say vocal. But I think that what, if anything, we've learned is for the good of the order is good for the party. And so it's the factions that are the divisive ones. And I think what we realized this time around is we found somebody, me being a timid Trump supporter, that actually answered more of our needs than less. And special interests weren't as involved in a more general kind of, there was a op-ed, whatever you call those, the cartoons today in the paper.
Right.
And it said, it was a bunch of elephants around the Thanksgiving table and said, we have to be thankful for unemployment and basic distrust of government.
Yeah, right, right. I've seen that.
That's
also,
the
I got
trough.
I've also got to say that one thing that made me laugh is somebody wrote in to the Post and said that Donald Trump has already made history because he's going to be the first billionaire to move into government housing being vacated by an African American family. So, you know, but the thing is that I think it depends on what factions win out, and over the next few weeks we'll see which group ends up being at the top of things. This guy's got 4,100 jobs to fill.
Yeah.
And I think part of it is he's starting to realize what an overwhelming task that is.
The fact that he appointed South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley for ambassador to the UN, who she was not a Trump supporter. She endorsed Rubio.
Right. So was a vocal critic of Trump's. And I would say that's one of the most positive things that I've seen him do is to, rather than hold that grudge, pick Nikki Haley. But Nikki Haley is also a darling of the Republican Party, too. I mean, and I understand why. I like her a lot. I think she's a good choice, even though she's been criticized for not having experience in that field. It's really not like you're making foreign policy up in the UN. It's more like you're the face of the administration. And if
the
I
liaison,
right, you're the liaison. And if I was in the Trump camp, I would say Nikki Haley was a great choice. You know?
Well, and then another one that they mentioned is the Chicago Cubs co-owner, Todd Ricketts. They're saying that he's considering Ricketts for a position in the Commerce Department, and Ricketts spent a bunch of money on not getting Trump to get the nomination. And what I'm trying to say is that it looks like he's not letting his volatility and that personality that we saw a lot of, and he's thinking with his head.
Well, I hope so, because this inside scuttlebutt around here is that it's going to be Wilbur Ross, who is the Commerce Secretary, and is going to be, nominated for Commerce Secretary, and he's a billionaire who is one of those people that was a Trump supporter and is very much the bad trade guy. He's a guy that for years has been talking about bad trade deals with the United States. So he's not only a Trump supporter, but he's on the same page as Trump, it seems, because that was a main campaign theme of Trump's. But one thing that I don't like about him is that he wants to impose steep tariffs on China, on products from China. And I'm a free trader. I just don't believe in tariffs. I don't.
Even though they're undermining their economy by artificially devaluing their money, I mean that's what makes it inequitable. Is that it's not really what it costs them to make it?
Yeah, it.
Which is why it's so damn cheap here.
Yeah, but I mean that's you know, haven't we, in as we develop economically, haven't we done exactly the same thing and just gone about it in a different way? You know, and this may be a good segue to talk about what just happened in Cuba, but didn't the United States create banana republics by doing the same thing, putting countries in a position that they could only produce a single cheap agricultural product because that's what we needed as raw material? I mean, all these economies, we can't control what the Chinese do. And I say, if the Chinese can make a better car and it's cheaper than the American cars, let's get the hell out of the car business and go into something else. I really believe that.
Well,
you know, we have to have free trade.
Just like water finds its own level, I think that's something that we would find out soon whether or not it was going to work or had the intended consequences, because otherwise we can't continue to struggle like that. So if it's I hear what you say, and I like the free trade idea because that's what made us great, right? But if we're dealing with artificial constraints, then that makes the playing field uneven. So it'll be very, his first 100 days are definitely going to be interesting.
Right.
And we can go to Fidel if you like.
Just briefly to say, because I want to hear what you have to say about this since you've been to Cuba. I've never been to Cuba. I find it interesting that, you know, I'm watching the news today and they're showing mourning people in Cuba, and then they're switching to Miami where people are dancing in the streets and singing, "Thank God Fidel is dead." I think it's interesting that he is the longest serving leader of any country in the world, with the exception of the Queen of England, who really doesn't run the country, right?
She's a figurehead, if you will.
Yeah, much more. And
the youngest leader in Latin America at the age of 32. So
yeah.
I had the privilege to travel there 5 years ago. It was sanctioned by the Department of the Treasury. Is that the correct name to say? Okay.
Department
or Treasury Department. And it was a humanitarian trip. And it was also cultural exposure too. We went and saw Hemingway's house, and we went to the theater, and we went to the museums. And but the one thing that I have to say that struck me was that at that time, 50 plus years of communism was a total and complete failure. And you know, 10 years maybe, 20 years maybe, 30 years, but 50 years and it's still not working, something needs to change. And I also had, they took us to this site that was about 2 hours away that was kind of a microcosm of a perfect world where everything, like you captured the rain and that's what you water the crops with and you composted this, and kind of a self-sustaining society that I think they were making an experiment out of. But driving there in the buses from Havana to this outpost, there was mile after mile after mile of verdant, fallow fields. And yet they had starving people and rations and everything in the cities. And I kept thinking, why wouldn't you develop crops here? What, you can feed your people, you can give them jobs. None of it made sense to me. And then, of course, what you see with the cars that were 50, 60 years old with Japanese engines in them now, or transmissions, still going around, adding, I mean, like nostalgia, I guess. But so Cuba's known for their rum, for their cigars, and for, I just spaced on it, rum, cigar, a third thing. Oh, coffee. And so I love all three of those. But the problem is that the best of the best always got exported. So what was left over is what the Cubans get to consume.
Well, you know, I mean, communism, look, it's very simple to me. Communism never succeeds because it's based on a faulty premise. You know, it's based on the idea, a beautiful idea that Karl Marx had, that people are basically good and they're alienated. Capitalism and democracy alienates them from the true nature. But the truth of the matter is, people are not basically good. They're basically and competition and interaction of everybody in society is what keeps them you know, keeps the balance, right? That's why it's important to have a Republican Party and a Democratic Party, to keep each side honest. And that's the problem with communism. There's nobody keeping it honest. So it gets corrupt very quickly. Power gets concentrated in a few hands. And, you know, and as an economic system, it's ridiculous. You can't plan economies. There's no such thing as a five-year plan that works as well as the market. The market responds instantly.
Are they idealistic or are they naive that you spend decades trying to implement and it's not working? It's unsuccessful.
I mean, well, I think you can see from the people in Miami that
they left there for a reason, right?
They knew it wasn't working. But what the hell are you going to do? And that's the problem, because with communism, like capitalism goes hand in hand with democracy, totalitarianism goes hand in hand with communism. So there's nothing you can do. I mean, look, you know, when you talk about being effective, you look at somebody like the Chinese, who had the worst incidences of venereal disease after the Second World War. It was so rampant in China that it was killing people, and they eliminated it completely. They're the only country in the world that's completely eliminated venereal disease. And they did it by saying, you're going to get inoculated against venereal disease or we're going to shoot you in the head. So that was very effective. People went, okay. You know, so in that sense, they can be effective, but not because it interferes with free will, and you know, people have to be free to choose. They really do.
Well, here's a quote from a Cuban-born economics professor. He's at the University of Pittsburgh, and he said he sums up Cuba's economy under Castro as he is an excellent politician, but he's a terrible economist. And
right.
I thought that said it all. It's like, yeah,
right.
You know, the field of dreams. But, you know, and under what odds and everything else that he came into power. Of course, it didn't hurt that the Soviet Union was behind it until they pulled out and left them suffering. But, you know, they had some nice world powers on their side. But nevertheless, now, one thing that I did get to see, too, when I was there, I was really surprised they exposed us to so much. That famous nightclub called the Tropicana.
Uh-huh.
And that the Rat Pack used to go to it and the mob got involved in it and all that stuff. That's still alive and well.
Wow.
And with their scanty Las Vegas, I guess Las Vegas took a lesson from them and started their shows with, you know, the pasties on the women's nipples.
Uh-huh.
And the privates that are, you know, have such a swatch of clothing on it. I was surprised to see that too. But I guess in the day they were considered, you know, really voluptuous and sensuous. And they used to arrange flights from Miami and have you back by 4 a.m. the next morning, which is why people could do the overnight junket. That was back in the heyday, I guess. Frank Sinatra, et cetera. So.
Yeah, it was a haven for the mafia. You know, they were so corrupt, and that, you know, that certainly led to the fall of Batista, right? And why did we support them? Well, we supported them because they weren't any problem, right?
Right.
You know, I remember I grew up in North New Jersey as a kid, and I remember one time when they were talking about crime in Newark and how much it had gone up in the neighborhoods. One of the mayors said it's because, you know, the federal government came in and cleaned out the mafia. That's why we have so much crime, because the mafia kept, you know,
people.
What I mean? They kept it. They there was just as much crime, I guess, but it was concentrated in a few hands, and it wasn't so much street crime, because that was bad for business, right? They didn't want people getting beat up and shot in the neighborhood unless there was some reason for it, you know?
Right.
If they wanted to do it, it was fine, you know? But I lived in the Italian neighborhood, and if you didn't get mixed up with those people, as a rule, you really didn't have much to worry about. You didn't want to borrow money from any of them or get involved with any of them, or you know what I mean? And sometimes innocent people just got hurt. But but there was kind of a sense of order that they were able to keep in the neighborhood, and that was, you know, that's why the people in Cuba hated us, because we supported the regime that allowed all this corruption to go on. But, you know, this is the other side of the coin of corruption, right? They brought Castro in, and in the end, he was even more corrupt. You know, and this is the challenge for Trump, and it's a challenge for all politicians, because we've seen many, many politicians who are great campaigners, but bad administrators, bad, you know, they're not good, you know, like he's not a good economist, Castro's not a good economist. Let's hope that the people we elect are good administrators, are good at running things, are good managers, because very often they're not. Very often they're, you know, there's a different set of skills to be a good campaigner.
Of course. And it also, though, at the end of the day, they also say, too, that the office is what shapes the individual, because you might have these pie in the sky plans or thoughts or dreams or goals. And then you get there and with the checks and balances and the three branches of government and what have you, and the lobbying and back scratching and all that goes on that you know better than any of us, which, by the way, do you watch House of Cards?
I do watch House of Cards. Yes.
I think of you because it's the first Netflix thing that I've ever watched, and I'm into season 4. I don't know how far it goes, but I'm like, Michael, is this what goes on?
Yeah, and you know what? I have such a crush on the first lady, Robin, what's her name? You know,
right?
Yeah, and she's so evil sometimes, and you know, and I blame this all on Rita Sarcone, who is a girl who beat me up in the third grade, and I fell in love with her. Yes, I do, and I remember she had four older brothers, and she just kicked the crap out of me, and I fell in love with her, and I've liked mean women ever since. But yeah, but
Mrs.
a lot
Brown
of that
included.
Goes on. Mrs. Brown, oh yes, she's the meanest of them all, you know. And I made a big mistake with Mrs. Brown. I let her get all the children on her side, so now it's the four of them against me. But yeah, I like it, and I also like, one of my favorite shows is a show called Veep with
Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Yeah, and it's a comedy, but there's also some of the same kind of thing that goes on. Like in one episode, for example, they're all talking about the Dalai Lama coming to the White House and how wonderful it is. And she walks into the room, she's the president, and they say, well, you know, the Dalai Lama's coming. And she turns around and she goes, oh, I hate that guy. You know, which, you know, because he's a lot of trouble, right? You know that they say things like that, you know, that in public they don't say things like that. But behind the scenes, they're going, oh, we're going to have extra security. And, you know, we're going to have to go get the right kind of tea. And yeah. And you know, but
House of Cards, there is no comic relief. It just goes from terrible to nasty to worse. And sometimes an episode ends and I'm like, oh my goodness, I have to go take a shower. This is disgusting. It's filthy. Yeah. It's nasty.
Oh yeah.
And it keeps on going. So it's riveting as hell. Plus the great acting and everything else. But I do think about you. And one of my buddies here in Southern California, he was in Congress for 33 years. He's been retired now a couple of years, and on House Intelligence and all that. And he's just the nicest man in the whole wide world. And he and his wife are adorable human beings. And I think he didn't stay around for 33 years because he was nice. Right.
Well, you know what? Some people are really wonderful, and especially the wives. The wives very often are the people that are the most important people on the campaign team. You know, you can have some of the wives are just unbelievable. They're just,
I bet,
brilliant and charming and sweet. And, you know, some of them have really on the Democratic side, for example, I think of people like Annie Glenn and, you know, some of these women had great reputations for being wonderful, wonderful, people. And, but to a large extent, yeah, it's a pretty nasty game. And I'll tell you, the people that take it the hardest on the chin are your family, you know, my wife, my kids. And I.
How is that? And why do you make that statement?
Because they take the criticism of you very personally.
I see.
You know, so I have my daughter call me crying one time because she read in the Washington Post that I was being accused of being a racist. And she called me crying. She said, Daddy, how can they say these things? She was in high school. How can they say these things about you? You know, you don't have a racist bone in your whole body and blah, 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 blah. And it really, really upset her. And I said, Tricia, this is just the way it is. And I used to say to my wife, Pat, you know, it's funny. There was a time when I had been beaten up and beaten up and beaten up in the press, and a reporter came to my wife and started talking to her, and Pat just went off on him. Actually, it was a female reporter from the Post, and just went off. And then at the end, after she was done with her like 2-minute tirade about how terrible they were, she said to the woman, "Oh my God, please don't print that. Please don't print that. Please don't print that." And the woman said to her, you know, because she could tell the angst that was involved in all of it, she said to Pat, "I won't print it. I know you're his wife. I won't print it."
Wow. You know?
But yeah, it gets very frustrating. And what I say to my wife all the time is, I say, look, if you're playing in the NBA and you don't want to take an elbow, you need to find another job. Because you know what? Throwing your elbows during a basketball game is the wrong thing to do. It's not right. It's not part of the rules. But you know what? Unfortunately, it's part of the game. And if you can't take it being shoved and pushed and eye gouged while you're out there, then you need to find something else to do. And that's in politics. If you don't have thick skin, it's not the right – running for public office certainly is not the right job for you. You know, Harry Truman said, if you want a friend in Washington, D.C., go buy a dog. and it's true, right? It's not a very nice thing. You know, I think sometimes this may be the problem that some of the Clinton people are having now, is that you know, it's different to be the candidate and be the person that supports the candidate.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I'm
sure. But I think, yes, there seems to be, it's in a tacit agreement between the two that, you know, we're in this together and what is mine is yours and et cetera. But when it's all said and done, history is being made by the person who got elected, not by whoever they're married to.
Right. And you know what? I mean, you have to accept it, right? That's the only way the system works. That's why you can have Mitt Romney, you know, show up and be embraced by Donald Trump 4 weeks after he said the man was reprehensible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I always say that's one of my favorite things is the day before the election, you're talking about what a terrible human being this is, how he deserves to be, you know, incarcerated or you know, eviscerated or something. And then the day after he wins, you're standing up saying, I'm so proud to work with the guy that I called
reprehensible.
You know, reprehensible, yes.
Before we close, we have to say goodbye to Florence Henderson.
Oh, Carol Brady. God.
Do you know that I read an op-ed today and the man said she wasn't just a sitcom mom. She was all of our moms. She was the moms that we didn't have. She was the moms we did have. She was the moms of our father's marriage. She was the stepmom of my dad's remarriage. I didn't realize she had this universal appeal. Knew her as, the Brady Bunch. I didn't also realize that ceiling-breaking that was.
And she had such a great career. She was on Broadway. She was part of the Today Show, one of the original people on the Today Show. But she evidently had a bad childhood, had a mother who was very cold, and she didn't have a relationship with her mother. She said in one interview I read that she tried to be the mother that she always wanted. Aww. And I think she tried to be the mother that we all always wanted or that we saw in our mothers. Those things, she brought out those characteristics that we saw in our mothers. And, you know, and I was a big Mrs. Brady fan. So,
do you remember Mr. Blackwell, Best Dressed? I don't know if he's still around or not. Well, he was feeling unwell one year, and she was his spokesperson, and I actually had the opportunity to interview her because he had just published his 10 Worst and Dressed Best Dressed Women. Mm-hmm. And you know what the funniest thing was? The Best Dressed Women, she was very conversant and very, you know, loquacious and stuff. And then when she got to the Worst Dressed, you could tell that it was like pulling teeth for her to even say something poorly about another person. And it wasn't even her words. It was his. But she was like, oh, I have a little trouble with this because, you know, everybody, we all try, and we have stylists, and we take their advice, and, you know, it's like, come on, let's see.
Yeah, because that's your mom, right? Your mom didn't ever say bad things about other people.
Right.
You know?
So I got it firsthand, with her, you know, on the phone with me as a guest, and I just thought that just made me like her even more, that she couldn't even say something, that it wasn't her opinion, it was Mr. Blackwell's opinion, and she had difficulty talking about the 10 Worst Dressed. Like, I know she felt badly for them. But this is not your name. You're just representing him. It's so cute. So that's
we didn't get to a lot of stuff today. We've still got to talk about Betsy DeVos and
another one who did support Trump.
Rens Priebus, right.
She contributed
and
to
look
a
at Priebus.
Against
Priebus
him.
Was... You know, I wouldn't have called him a supporter. I would have said, I think he was drugged to the, table, kicking and screaming. And of course, we really got to talk about Stephen Bannon and some of these other people. But we'll do that in the future. And America, stay out there and stay strong. And go ahead, Maria. You say goodbye, and we'll see everybody next week.
And we will, and we hope you have a wonderful post-Thanksgiving week and that you still remain in gratitude. Thank you for your time. Give the people their right to vote.